Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5110, Guadalupe L. Garcia for himself and on behalf of G.A. Garcia and Sons Farm et al. Appellants versus Ed Schaefer, Secretary, United States Department of Agriculture. Case number 08-5135, Rosemary Love et al. Appellants versus Ed Schaefer, Secretary, United States Department of Agriculture. Mr. Hill for Appellants Garcia et al., Ms. Wall for Appellants Love et al., and Mr. Scarborough for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Stephen Hill, on behalf of the Garcia appellants, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, please. At issue here, Your Honor, is whether Section 741 constitutes an adequate remedy in the court, as that term is used in APA 704. In Bowen v. Massachusetts, the Supreme Court construed that provision to mean simply that Congress did not intend by that provision to duplicate previously existing special statutes that existed at the time the APA was enacted. Congress expressly reaffirmed that holding and construction in the Darby case when it said, quote, Congress intended by that provision simply to avoid duplicating previously established.
But we haven't, have we? Isn't the gravamen of your argument that we're going to have to overturn 30 years of precedent in this court on that comes from the Council of and for the Blind in its line of cases?
Well, with respect, Your Honor, we think the court failed to consider.
So the answer to that is yes, right?
No, not necessarily. Okay. Even if you reject that argument,
we can't do that, right?
Beg your pardon?
We're a three-judge panel. We can't do that. You'd have to convene on bank.
In point of fact, I don't want to spend a lot of my little time on this point, but in point of fact, where there has been an intervening Supreme Court decision, you can recognize that there has been an error here.
We've had lots of cases since Bowen that have taken a completely different view.
Setting Bowen to one side, the case law is clear, as this court said in Santa Cruz, El Rio Santa Cruz, and the Bowen court said, the test of an adequate remedy is a practical one, not a theoretical one. Here, the undisputed testimony of Rosalind Gray, the former director of the Office of Civil Rights, is that the attempts to implement Section 741 were effectively sabotaged.
Let me ask you, in response to this, these claimants have pursued an action. The cause of action here is in part the civil action under 741A, right?
Yes.
Okay. I understand you're trying to raise an APA cause of action, but there's no doubt that these claimants elected A.
Well,
let me ask my question.
Yes, sir.
You had to have elected one or the other, because the statute says in lieu of. So you can either go A or B, 741A or B. I just want to confirm, because the government asserts, and you didn't in your briefs, neither one of you suggested the contrary. The elections here was 741A.
Oh.
Everybody.
Yes.
Yes, okay. Now, if there's 741A, I'm not sure what the argument is over inadequate remedy. You have an adequate remedy. And this is to say nothing about the horrible record of inaction, I won't characterize it, the horrible record about what the agency has and has not done. So Congress stepped in and they said, we're giving you this relief, A or B. You pick it. All of these claimants picked A. What's inadequate about court relief, save for the fact you don't have a class action? Which I realize, as a practical matter, is a serious problem, but you don't have it. You lost that one. What's inadequate about a court action?
Well, Your Honor, we've only lost it if you conclude today that there isn't a cause of action for the failure to investigate.
But the thing is, we're going around in circles. It is inadequate alternative, and so you can't have the APA claim. Your APA claim, failure to investigate, is really another way of characterizing your complaints about discrimination. They're failure to investigate discrimination claims. So that would be under B. If you folks had really wanted to challenge the agency's failure to process the claims, and I'm not saying there isn't something there, it seems to me the way you do it is you file B, and you then seek a track-type mandamus action and come in and say to the court, they promulgated regulations to implement B, and they're doing nothing. And under a long line of cases in the D.C. Circuit, Your Honors, you can compel them to act. You made the opposite election. You went A.
Well, I
want to give you, that's where my concern is with this case. Well, now, you tell me what the answer is to that.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, precisely because the efforts that were undertaken to sabotage the implementation of 741, there wasn't, as Director Gray said, there wasn't notice given that was reasonably calculated to alert minorities, Hispanics, and women about the existence of this process. As a practice.
Which process? Remember, we're talking A or B. Congress comes in, Congress says
process.
You're saying, in effect, you were forced to come to court because there was nothing available under B?
There was in fact nothing available under B. There was no notice to Hispanic and women farmers about the B process.
No, but I mean, once 741 was passed, you were on notice that at least Congress said you had this alternative to filing directly in court.
As a practical matter, Your Honor, what we're saying is that was illusory because the farmers never got that notice.
Notice of what?
That there was this option out there.
No, but I mean, once Congress passes the statute
right. Everyone knows is A and B. You knew the attorneys, whoever was representing them, knew because you elected A.
The attorneys who had the case at that time elected A
right.
Because time was running out, and that was the only option.
You could have elected B.
Isn't your argument that B wasn't working? They just failed? Wasn't that...
B is, that's exactly right.
Now, wait, was the case tried that way in the district court? That we didn't want to make this election. We have been forced to make this election. See, I'm not...
We've never gotten...
That would be an in-the-door argument. You walk in the door, we're here because the time is running. We have to be here.
That's exactly right.
But this isn't where we prefer to be. We would prefer to use the B option.
Well, with respect, Your Honor,
See, the easy answer, and maybe it's easy in hindsight, and I'm saying this respectfully, because it's always complicated when you're right in the middle of it, but when you look at this thing in retrospect, a way to go after it, because the time is going to be lost anyway, apparently, you go B, and then you seek mandamus.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I think B is another form of rehearing, if you will. The refusal and the failure of the USDA to investigate over many years, that constituted a final action sufficient to get review in the court under the APA under 704. And 704 is quite clear. All B
You're
does.
Claiming they failed to follow to implement the regulations that were promulgated to enforce 741B.
That's absolutely right.
Okay.
And
so wait. Just hear my question. I understand that. So that if that really is your argument, then you file under 741B and you attempt to pursue the procedures given to you under those regulations. And when they're not forthcoming. That's a mandamus action.
The point here, Your Honor, is...
In other words, I don't know how you can contest procedures without attempting to invoke them.
In other words, I understand your response to be that because the agency had not acted for many, many years, they had, for purposes of Article III jurisdiction, finally acted.
Yes.
So that when you filed your complaint under A... You also included an APA track type claim.
Absolutely, Your
and
Honor.
And so you're saying that that type of claim survives.
Yes, Your
and
Honor.
Given the unrebutted evidence of Mrs. Gray, you are properly in court insofar as jurisdiction is concerned under the APA.
Yes,
but
Your Honor.
I want to go where I think we were, is that when Judge Edwards was asking you what's inadequate about coming into court under A.
Well,
which is where you are. You're in court under A.
There, my position is if we are permitted to go forward with our APA claims under A, there's nothing inadequate about that. But if what you're saying is an optional procedure that the court said, the government said it was clearly optional, they used the term may. And under 704, it's quite clear once you have reached finality in the first instance, you don't have to take advantage of any.
I don't know how you can be in court under both mandamus related to B and a civil suit under A, which
I'm
is what you just said to Judge Rogers.
I don't
you're
believe.
Filing, yes, you're saying you're here let me tell you what I heard, and you tell me if I'm wrong. Okay? I'm trying to understand the theory of this case. You said you no doubt you're here under A, and you're saying you're also here track type case, seeking mandamus with respect to B.
No.
Well, you can't be in
no.
both because the statute says in lieu of. You have to pick one or the other.
Now, the criticism and the factual criticism of B goes to the point that the district court specifically invokes the failed policies of B, the failed procedures of B, as evidence that this 741 is an adequate.
No. Well, let me just give you my take on it so you can respond. That's an incorrect way to both ask and answer the question. When you're looking at adequacy, you look at A. Is A adequate? That's the proper question. Not whether had you used B, would B have been adequate, because that's a mandamus question. You're in here under A. The proper question for the district court and for us is A an adequate alternative? And it seems to me, I don't know why it isn't.
And
Mr. Hill, what are you trying to get under A? What's the relief you're seeking?
Under A, we're trying to get
systemic relief. You're trying to get an overhaul so that they'll do B, right?
No, systemic relief can be a loaded term here. This isn't one of those cases that is not situation specific. Here, each and every plaintiff was discriminated against by the USDA. Each and every plaintiff.
But the relief you want is that the USDA will
enforce
will create the system that B speaks to.
No,
right?
No, not at all.
You want relief for the individual plaintiffs.
We want relief for the individual plaintiffs, and we want the USDA to enforce its existing regulations with respect to the investigating discrimination complaints.
Well, you see
if I can understand this. In other words, you're saying that while an individual plaintiff may obtain relief under ECOA, what you also want is relief at the administrative level, namely that the agency follow its own regulations, so that the individual farmer, while he or she obtains an award, those farmers out there, as it were, can obtain relief on an ongoing basis from the agency, as opposed to here we're in 2009, and this case we're talking about claims filed back in the late 90s.
Right.
Is that the point you?
I think you've encapsulated it perfectly. Your
now,
Honor.
Judge Edwards said, or observed that, you know, not having class certification creates obstacles, but that's water over the dam as far as we three judges are concerned.
Not necessarily.
Well, it's already yes.
Well,
if I may be heard, Your Honor. It may help to go back and understand the history of these cases. There were four identical cases filed. And in two of those cases, they were certified for classes were certified on the basis of both ECOA and APA claims on the failure to investigate.
You're talking about
Pigford and Kiepsiegel. And only in our cases did Judge Robertson say, in effect, Judges Sullivan and Friedman made a mistake as a matter of law.
I know, but all I'm saying is that three judges of this court have already affirmed Judge Robertson's ruling.
Only with respect to what he said was, I'm not going to certify a class on the basis of the failure to investigate. You're going to have to prove more. We went out and set about trying to do that, and on the basis of the alternative grounds that we were forced to assert, he rejected those under 23F. He then said, in light of my ruling on your alternative grounds, I'm going to certify the failure to investigate claim because that now is critical. This court never reached that second point. And it seems to me.
So your point is that were we to reverse the district court on the dismissal of the APA claim, the question of whether you could get a class certification would still be open?
I would think so, Your Honor. And the question I would have to ask is, if there is, first Judge Robertson said, if there is an APA claim, then class certification follows automatically. Now, and then the question I would have to ask and my clients are going to ask is, what's different about Hispanic farmers and women farmers that they can't get a class certified on the failure to investigate, and African American and Native Americans can? So that's the problem. And with respect to our APA claims, the judge appears to have dismissed our substantive APA claims, our APA claims with respect to discrimination in the non-credit programs.
Well, that's a different issue. Yeah, I mean, he's on much softer ground there. There's no question about that. But that, I mean, the bigger issue is the one we've been talking about.
I appreciate it, Your Honor. But again, if I'm right on this, and in the colloquy with Judge Rogers, what we're saying is, A would be an adequate remedy if we're allowed to go forward with our APA claim, because there was finality with respect to
the problem is we're just going in circles. When you say it, of course it would be nice to have more, but the problem is we're dealing with 704, and if A is adequate, it's adequate.
But
it's adequate to give you the relief that you're seeking, which is, in answer to your question to Judge Rogers, you said, well, yeah, we'd like to have a large relief for those folks who aren't even here. So going forward, there would be no problems. Well, where's the standing issue? I mean, how do you deal with standing with respect to those who are not before us? Those who are before us have relief under A. Not as good as if it were class action, but they have relief under A.
Well, if
and you picked A, and the statute says you got to go one or the other. And your APA claim is a B claim. It's a mandamus claim hooked to B, and you didn't go B.
With respect, Your Honor, I couldn't disagree more. All B does is give those farmers who want to resubmit themselves to the flawed USDA process the opportunity to do so. But they're under no requirement to do so because
you got A.
Because the long years.
Because you got A.
The long years of delay.
That's the reason they're not required to do it. They've got A, and okay. They can come into court and say, we're not going to go the administrative.
And one of the things they can get under A is their failure to investigate claim. That's what McKenna stands for. McKenna says very clearly that you can sue the government when you're suing the government directly, and you're not in a situation where you have the government funding third parties, and it's the third party that's discriminating. Here, the government is discriminating,
McKenna is plainly inapposite because it involves a situation where the procedures that I was on the case, I remember it quite well, involves a procedure that was beneficial to all employees without regard to a discrimination claim. The government had to follow certain procedures in dismissals, and they say, we have our Title VII claim, and we're also saying, we have their failure to follow their own procedures that govern all employees who are going to be thrown out. It was right then, it's still right, and it's completely different. Your failure to investigate claim is only about discrimination. Well, it's about the implementation of the regulations going to 741, discrimination.
But that is a a separate cause of action. It's a separate.
Merely saying it doesn't make it so.
Let's try to make it so this way with the facts. The discrimination that took place was out in the fields, in the local offices. When you filed a discrimination complaint, as the rules, as USDA said you were entitled to do and could rely on, a separate department, a separate group were supposed to investigate the discrimination complaints. Why is that important? These are farmers who, by definition, to be eligible for the USDA program, are limited means and limited resource farmers. They can't go out and file a federal lawsuit every time they're discriminated against. There is a valuable interest that exists in those regulations that say, if you're discriminated against, you can come in and invoke the services of the United States Department of Agriculture to investigate on your behalf, to make findings, and to implement those findings.
Now, isn't that what, if B were working correctly, let me just finish, because I'm really trying to understand what you're saying. If the agency had faithfully done what Congress intended for them to do, isn't that exactly what you'd get under B? If the agency had done what Congress asked it to do and had faithfully adopted administrative procedures under B, that you and I and your co-counsel would all agree these are terrific procedures and everyone understands they're there, they're available, and you can file your claim. That's what B does, right?
If you chose to ignore the fact that you are already in a situation of finality with respect to administrative action and say, well, I'll give them another chance, because Congress has said, you can give them another chance. Notice it didn't say you have to, it said you may. And all of that is another form of optional reconsideration. We had the basis to go forward and assert our APA claims. Judge Robertson acknowledges that we have asserted very carefully tailored injunctive relief that could be issued on the basis of our claim going forward under A. But
well, if that is so, back to Judge Griffith's question, doesn't that argue against your position then that A is inadequate?
No.
If you can obtain broad injunctive relief under A, pursuing
you can only obtain the full measure of relief if you are basing it on findings with respect to the failure to investigate claim. That's the point I'm trying to get across.
All right, counsel, we've taken up a lot of your time. We'll give you some time. Let us hear from counsel for.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Your Honors. Barbara Wall for the Love Appellants, and I've reserved 2 minutes. And I'd like to jump right into the questions that you've already been asking, co-counsel. Just to take a step back, we are here under the APA because neither 741A nor 741B is adequate, in fact, at all available in some respects, to address the appellant's cause of action for the agency to follow its own regulations. And that is a failure to investigate. Specifically,
failure to investigate discrimination claims.
Correct. Failure to investigate discrimination claims.
And this, of course, you understand in answering this question I'm going to ask, the failure to investigate is inexorably tied to the discrimination claim, which is supposedly addressed in 741B. That is, it's all part of the 741B and A package. In proceeding under A or B, a court would consider in A whether or not the agency has considered the claim and whether or not relief is due. And under B, it's obvious that that's part if you go B. So it's tied. It's inexorably tied, meaning it's not separate from and apart from A and B. That's the question, okay?
I understand your question, Your Honor. And let me back up a minute. This court found in Love versus Johannes that we don't state a claim for the failure to investigate under ECOA.
Standing alone.
Correct. Okay. Standing alone. So we don't have any access to the court under ECOA for a failure to investigate.
You do if you accept my framing, which is that in any discrimination claim, that would always be part of the conversation.
Well, Judge Henderson, if I recall correctly from the questioning sitting right over there where Judge Griffith said, specifically the statute ECOA does not say on its face that it has anything to do with investigation.
Standing alone as a cause of action, I understand. But what I'm saying in a discrimination claim, a failure to investigate, is always going to be part and parcel of the consideration of the discrimination claim.
Your Honor, I do believe sitting in that seat several years ago, you did make that point, and we read, as apparently did the majority in the Love case, that when you state an ECOA claim, it looks at whether there's been discrimination in the credit decision. And whether the agency has in fact investigated is immaterial because that has been not included in ECOA. So we construed, I think appropriately based on this court's decision, that standing alone, as you say, we can't include a failure to investigate claim under A. So A is out for us. With regard to B, we never have attempted, as you pointed out, to go under B. It was the district court that injected B into the process because Judge Robertson said, you've got adequate claims under A, which I'll come back to in a minute, and you've got adequate claims under B. And our position, with due respect, is that we have neither. The reason why we don't have any we don't have adequate remedy under A, is first and foremost that this court said the failure to investigate claim can't be pursued under A, because that's what you said in Love versus Johannes. Secondly, they are different injuries. One is, has there been
that's really the question, and I was about to ask you, so you anticipated, so I'm really curious as to what we're talking about, because we're really talking about remedying discrimination, but go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, actually Judge Robertson made a big distinction between the remedies being different and the injuries being the same. The easy point to answer your question is that the remedies are totally different. Under ECOA, the remedy is principally money damages, and there's some injunctive relief, but that's in the nature of giving an individual something. Under the agency's rubric, under its regulations, which is what we are saying we are entitled to in our APA claim, the agency has vast discretion to be able to issue all kinds of remedies that are non-available pursuant to ECOA, including looking at the discriminatory division, employee action based on the employee who has discriminated, audits of the agency, debt cancellation that go beyond the actual discrimination that the individual suffered. In that regard, the ECOA damages and the APA agency damages are apples and oranges.
But let me ask you, aren't you hard up against Congress understanding that those were the complaints your clients had? Responding, saying, all right, 741, we're going to give you two more years to pursue either A or B.
Well, they didn't say pursue A or B.
Well, they said, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Specifically, they said with regard to 740A that there'd be a waiver of the statute of limitations with regard to credit transactions. Mm-hmm. That's not a discussion about the agency failing to follow its own regulations. It was very specific with regard to credit transactions. And then they went on to say, we're going to give you this other remedy, but the remedy under 741B, with due respect to Judge Edwards, was completely flawed. Notwithstanding, or I should say in addition to Ms. Gray's statement that it just was dysfunctional, never worked, etc. If you look at 741B on its face, it is, in the words of both the Santa Cruz case and in Bowen, a doubtful remedy, because you had to, as a claimant, jump through four hoops before you could actually get to federal court. You had to have a complaint acknowledged by the agency. You had to have had the agency actually investigate your claim. You had to have had a resolution by the agency. And then you had to have had adverse action.
That's true in any APA case in which you want to seek court review. Any APA remedy is like that. You just described what people have to go through fairly routinely in order to be able to get court review of an APA action.
Well, usually the APA review is more like, has there been finality and is there a...
No. But, I mean, you've got to go through the hoops. If you want to eventually come to court and seek review on an APA cause of action, you had to have gone through the agency. We see this every day, where people have spent years going through the APA, going through agency procedures, ALJs, the agency, petitions for reconsideration, and if you don't jump all those hoops, you don't get to court. So, but you're saying that's all flawed, but that's where you want to be.
Well, with due respect, Judge, I believe that the statute, 741B, spells out a very narrow opportunity for the claimants to use this temporary, it was only a two-year opportunity. On its face, there were questions, doubtful ability for the claimants to actually get into court, beyond what is normal in an APA case. I understand the finality.
Well, what in addition? Forget the fact that the agency has a history in this case that is unpleasant to look at, and that's reported by those who've separately investigated it. All right, forget that. But what's otherwise different about the hoops that have to be jumped than you otherwise would follow in an administrative process? Administrative process is not easy on anyone in any of these agencies.
I would agree with that. The exact words of 741B make it slightly more difficult because they refer to an adverse action. They refer to an eligible complaint. That coupled with the fact that the agency, as you point out, wasn't working, it wasn't working at all, indicates that this is exactly the kind of doubtful remedy or doubtful approach that doesn't constitute an adequate remedy under 704.
Well, I think I know what you're going to ask, but the response to that, of course, is let's pretend Congress really did understand this. They said, well, that might be an issue, so if that looks bad to you, go A.
Well, what they said about A was interesting, Your Honor. They said specifically, A is not a substitute. Specifically, what they said was, we are extending or waiving the statute of limitations because when this horrible history of discrimination against minority farmers came to light and Secretary of Agriculture Glickman finally attempted to do something about it, the Justice Department said, we're going to invoke the statute of limitations. So the legislative history says specifically the only reason for the waiver of the statute of limitations was not to provide an alternative remedy, but only to give those claimants their day in court, to remove the obstacle.
I wondered whether your argument didn't come down to the fact that Congress provided a relief pursuant to 741. But it wasn't occupying the field, if I can draw by analogy. That just hypothetically, there may have been 10 statutes out of there, that 10 statutes on the books, which could have provided the plaintiffs with various forms of relief. Congress focused on a couple, but it didn't say we're exhausting the field such that 741 is deemed to replace all 10 statutes that have previously existed on the books.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I need some substance to that.
Right.
Because at least the way this, you know, limited legislative history we have is Congress is responding directly to the very types of complaints you are raising now and says, here's our decision on how you should proceed. We'll give you two options. And in effect, that says we are occupying the field.
Well, they didn't give two options. All they did was release the statute of limitations as an obstacle. They didn't do anything else in A. In B, they said, well, we understand some of these problems.
Well, they create a cause of action, and be a direct cause of action, any civil action to obtain relief with respect to discrimination alleged by an eligible complainant. And then B says the complainant may, in lieu of the civil action, pursue the administrative course.
But let me just be clear on your answer. You're saying in A, all Congress did was say there's a statute out there, the statute of limitations under that statute has run. We're going to extend that for 2 years. And then it said if you don't want to go directly into court under that statute, you can file a claim with the agency.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, specifically, the there's more than legislative history on that point, but I'm going to read you one specific quote that I think is very telling. This was Senator Robb said, the amendment I offered to this year's appropriations bill eliminates this legal obstacle, meaning the statute of limitations, and allows farmers to pursue their claims of discrimination. It allows them to have their day in court, so to speak. That was all it did. It didn't occupy the field. It didn't prevent any other approach. It gave them an opportunity to have
any other approach to what end?
To any cause of action they wanted to pursue, if they could.
In other words, is it to what end, the end being the same as we're talking about here, discrimination, ECOA?
Well, again, that goes back, I think, to your point of, is there a difference between a claim that arises under ECOA and a claim that arises to complain about the agency's failure to adhere to its own regulations?
Right. And those regulations were written to implement the 741B.
Well, the regulations actually were not. There are two sets of regulations. Originally, there was 741. Let me back up. Originally, there were the agency's regulations going back to the 1960s that said that the agency was required to investigate complaints, do certain things, come to a resolution. There were another set of regulations that were implemented in the 80s that were a little more detailed. Sometime after the passage of 741 in 1999, there was another set of regulations. And actually, at that point, there were two sets of regulations, one that addressed the 741B process and included an ALJ, 180 days, all the bells and whistles that the 741B process was supposed to allow for implementation. And then there was separately, already in existing, the agency's regulations that didn't have those bells and whistles. As we know from both the...
In this case, and I just don't recall the answer to this, in this case, are you and your co-counsel claiming failure to follow which regulations are you claiming you failed to follow, the agency failed to follow?
It depends when you filed your complaint. And at its bare bones,
the failure to investigate, you have to point to something in the regulation. Judge Robertson didn't think, he had doubts about whether it was in anything that he was looking at, but now I'm asking you specifically, what are you pointing to? Which set of regulations are you pointing to? The ones that were promulgated to implement 741B or the other ones?
Well, Your Honor, again, it depends when you as the claimant filed your administrative complaint. If I filed my administrative complaint before the 741B regulations were promulgated and eventually merged with the agency's regular regulations, then I have to go back to those regulations. But if you're asking me, and you may be, what happens if I succeed in my claim here before you and you send this back and say the agency has to do its job, in that regard, the agency's current regulations would have to be employed. Because
all right, let me go back to what's concerning me here. Back to my hypothetical situation where there are 10 statutes on the books and then 741 comes along. Even accepting what I understand to be your analysis of the limited scope of 741, there's nothing to indicate that Congress intended that the courts would not apply their traditional analysis under Bowen and certainly under this court's line of cases with counsel and Wheel, such that in defining what adequate means, it's not perfect, it's not necessarily fulsome, and then the concern about duplication. So even if we were to accept this, what I'll call a narrow view of what Congress intended, I don't know how you get over the duplication issue in light of how this circuit has defined what is an, quote, adequate remedy.
If the question, Your Honor, is whether under the counsel line of cases, the other remedies are adequate, we believe that is not the case here, in part because there is no availability under those other remedies, under those other statutes, for our claimants to be able to get the agency to adhere to its own regulations. There is no other statute. Those other 10 that you're hypothetically proposing that Congress addressed, they don't address and allow the claimants to say that the agency has to adhere to its own regulations. That is an important right here, because as this court said in Lopez and in other cases, where these claimants have no other safeguards, they're at the mercy of this agency, and the complaints of the claimants have gone unheeded for 40 plus years. There's nothing except the regulations to provide safeguards to these claimants.
The argument might be in response, look, Congress has said you can go into court, and while it's a burdensome procedure, that's sort of the nature of the beast, and you can just recover damages against the agency.
But damages, Your Honor, are exactly what's not sufficient here. And that's not what these claimants have asked for. What they've asked for is appropriate relief that the agency has under its regulations.
And along the lines Judge Edwards was exploring, our first decisions, that our decisions in the first interlocutory appeals, don't bar any form of injunctive relief.
The injunctive relief available under ECOA is not the same injunctive relief available pursuant to the agency's regulations.
Why don't we hear from counsel for appellee here, and then.
May it please the court, Charles Scarborough for the Secretary of Agriculture. I just want to step back with two points that are undisputed and are very important here, and the court has touched on them, of course. And the first is that in 1998, Congress passed Section 7741 to remedy this precise problem of USDA's failure to process discrimination complaints and gave what it perceived to be the proper remedy. It didn't say we're going to allow you to go back to court and make track-type claims. It said we're going to give you option one, go in and file an ECOA suit to remedy the underlying discrimination, or option two, go back to the agency and prescribe specific timelines within B by which the agency had to make decisions and then made that judicially reviewable.
They could have gotten track relief if they had gone B and the agency has done what it's done, which is nothing.
I agree with the first part of it. Anybody at this point, just like in any other agency procedure, if an agency sits on a claim for long enough such that it violates 7061 under track and the applicable precedents, anybody at any point could get track relief, including anyone who filed a claim now and the agency sits on it for too long. I completely agree with that. I don't agree that there's been any showing that the agency, after Congress addressed this problem, has been sitting on anything.
I wouldn't go that far. Have the GAO report, if nothing else.
Well,
I mean, the one thing about this case is there isn't any serious question on that. This is not a model of agency action.
Again, we're not here.
At least I hope not. Yes, we are here to consider that in part. That is one of the reasons that this case becomes hard, is because in my 29 years in terms of agency reticence, let's call it that, inaction, bad behavior, if you're going to go to the extreme, this ranks right up there. And that certainly gives flavor to this case as we struggle with how to deal with it. So don't self-righteously suggest that on behalf of the agency, that the agency has just moved right along. They haven't moved right along. That's why we're here.
I'm not suggesting the agency, and I'm not trying to be self-righteous in any respect. I'm suggesting that Congress looked at this problem in 1998 and addressed it.
They were very upset.
I completely agree with you. They were very upset, and everyone knew, and that precipitated a rash of filings, as they were entitled to do under the ECOA. Lots of different class actions, the Pigford case, the Keepsiegel case.
Well, let me ask you, of course, Pigford was, you know, consent judgments. So,
that's correct.
And we haven't seen the other case yet, but.
You actually have on one interlocutory appeal in the Keepsiegel case.
Right.
That we tried to take it up on class certification. The court didn't reach this APA issue because that was the predicate for certifying the class in that case. Judge Sullivan
right.
thought there was an APA failure to investigate claim. We said, well, it's not actionable for this 704 reason, the same argument we're making here.
Let me ask you.
Sorry.
741 is part of an appropriation statute. So as far as I could find, we don't have the what I'll call fulsome congressional process where you have committee hearings, subcommittee hearings, committee consideration, et cetera. Given what counsel for appellants Love and I were just discussing about what Congress actually did in 741A, it said, we're going to extend the statute of limitations, but it didn't address a lot of other things. Even with our circuit's precedent about what is the nature of an adequate remedy, given our opinion in the first interlocutory appeals in these cases that you cannot bring a failure to investigate claim under ECOA, how can the plaintiffs obtain the type of relief they seek beyond individual damages, such that these cases that talk about, well, it's a remedy or relief of the same genre, when, we're talking about apples and oranges here?
Well, I'm not sure that we're talking about apples and oranges. I mean, Congress was aware of the history here and said, this is what you get. You can come in under ECOA and have a suit for damages. And I think it's really important not to minimize the extraordinary nature of that relief, sweeping back all the way to 1981 and waiving the ECOA limitations period and allowing suits for damages against the discriminating entity.
I know, but counsel, we're sitting here having, some of us have sat on the Pigford case. We've read the GAO report. So, exactly how great this relief is a little doubtful. And that's why I'm asking about does that sort of environment or context necessarily force the court to evaluate what kind of relief you really can get under an ECOA as distinct from an APA-type systemic form of injunctive relief?
Well, again, you can get substantial relief under ECOA. Under the Pigford settlement, millions of dollars have been paid out in that case. In this case...
Yeah, but that's because the agency wasn't contesting, okay? That was a consent judgment.
I understand, Your Honor.
Here, the agency is not going along with the plaintiffs.
But the point is, the plaintiffs, we're not trying to deprive any plaintiff of their ECOA day in court.
So tell me what they can recover under ECOA.
They can recover damages, compensatory damages, for the improper discriminatory denial.
All right.
Of
suppose I'm Farmer Garcia, and I recover, $100,000 from the agency based on my discrimination claim. But I have an ongoing farm, and I'm trying to get loans, I'm trying to get other forms of relief. And the agency is non-functional. So I have my $100,000. It may tide me over for a year or two. But I need, continuous assistance from the agency. And it's not there. And that's the nature of these complaints. How do I, through an ECOA cause of action, get that type of relief?
Well, I don't think you do get that type of relief through an ECOA action. But let me then add to that, I think you have available to you, just as any other person who is subject to a federal agency's regime, you have the ability to go into court if you try to use the apparatus and it is unreasonably delayed and make a track sort of claim. So to this day, any one of these people who has an ongoing relationship
could. You have to be a non-eligible claimant to file the track, is what you're arguing. The non-eligible person is the only one, or that group is the only group that can pursue the APA claim? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think that is what I'm saying, Your Honor.
Can the eligible complainants do that?
I'm saying that this case is about the people who chose the A, the ECOA damages action.
You're telling me that I, as Farmer Garcia, can go right downstairs today and file an APA claim. Then the district court says, I have two cases by Appellant Garcia. I'm going to consolidate the cases. I mean, what have we gained?
I'm not sure the district court would say something like that.
You mean consolidate the cases?
No, we're deep into speculation because it's a totally different sort of claim. These cases that are before you now are about the past failures of USDA to act on credit discrimination. They are in the period of 1981 to 1996, denials of loans, other forms of credit. It's a systemic problem there. They have what Congress gave them in 1998, which is an extraordinary remedy. It's you can go in and sue this agency under ECOA without regard to the statute of limitations.
Oh, but at least in the Garcia case, don't we have some who filed after the 741 period?
Some who filed after the 741
period? Yes, they have claims that were filed after whatever the date is, July.
Well, I think I understand your point. They were within the normal ECOA two-year limitations period. I understand that. But the point is all these cases were filed in 2000. So to the extent someone came in tomorrow and said, the agency has sat on my administrative complaint of discrimination for 3 years and just hasn't done anything, they would be entitled to bring a track claim just like anybody else would be entitled to come to court and say, agency has unreasonably delayed. And it would be subject to the...
Even though they have this pending... ECOA claim?
I think so, because it'd be an entirely different set of harms. I mean, I'm trying to focus the court on these claims here in Garcia and Love are focused on past credit discrimination. Certainly, things that are prior to 2000 when the claims were filed.
I don't understand, counsel, why that doesn't concede the appellant's point. They are saying that it may be in the past, but the point is we're in court now. There's a track claim. And we want to get the type of relief that the APA can get us, that we can't get under ECOA.
Are you saying because they haven't pursued any administrative claims?
Yes.
I understand how you're building your theory.
I don't understand why you're saying that, or explain to me, because I thought these plaintiffs, at least some of them, were saying that they tried to get loans, but they were denied applications, they weren't provided the right information, et cetera. So, to that extent, let's just hypothetically assume that that was an exhaustion. And even in the cases where they actually file the application, the agency sat on it for years and years and years, so they have a track claim. Why isn't that part of
I don't think it's a part of it because they...
Because why?
Because they all use the A mechanism here. They are all in court asserting the 741A mechanism, the right to file the suit, under ECOA. And again, part of the problem here is that we have to talk at a level of abstraction because of the sort of the class certification backdrop to this, that we're talking about so many different types of people here that really it would be much easier to parse out if you were talking about, individual claims. And that's, in our view, where this case should ultimately go. There should be individual claims for under the ECOA,
for damages. What about counsel's point that we started out with, that where is the indication that Congress intended to wipe out all these other statutory remedies? It just said, look, we're going to extend the statute of limitations for 2 years. It didn't say we're barring you from also filing an APA claim.
Well, I don't think that the test is congressional intent to wipe out other things. I mean, the test under this court's precedent, I believe, is duplicative proceedings here. And I mean, if you allow sort of the ECOA claims to proceed, which clearly all these plaintiffs want to do, they want to go forward on their ECOA claims under A, and you at the same time have some sort of other APA thing happening for failure to process complaints, I mean, you have sort of a two-track system. You could have a situation in which, a plaintiff ultimately does not succeed on an ECOA claim, and you could have, an order to investigate that ultimately unsuccessful claim. It's just a bizarre process that, precisely the type of thing that 704 is designed to preclude. It's designed to preclude that kind of duplicative
proceeding. The way
you're
constructing it in your mind, when you envision the possibility of track, is that any one of these plaintiffs could pursue under agency regulations a claim outside of this past discrimination window.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Get stonewalled, and then seek track mandamus relief.
That's correct, but it's not a part of this case in which the plaintiffs are seeking to avail themselves of the remedy that Congress provides.
Judge Rogers pointed to the possibility of some such plaintiffs in Garcia.
Well, again, part of the problem here is that we're talking about a sort of a loose affiliation of individual plaintiffs now that's really not aggregated as a class.
No, we're not talking about that, counsel. We're talking here at the very threshold of this case. Now, whether they can prove their case is a different issue. The question is whether or not they're entitled to include this APA-type claim at the beginning. And what you're telling me, as I understand it, is Farmer Garcia could go downstairs and file an APA complaint now based on track, citing the very same incidents that he has alleged in his complaint here, and that would be a proper action.
Well, no, not the very same incidents that are alleged in this case.
Well, why
wouldn't it? Well, to the extent that you're availing yourself of the OCOA remedy, you're taking the thing that Congress has given you in 1998, and you're taking the thing that Congress thought was adequate, a way of dealing with this problem.
Well, back to my Garcia plaintiff who has filed post 741. All right, that's the person I'm talking about now. In other words, there are some plaintiffs in the Garcia case, I think it's in paragraphs 5 and 33 of their complaint, who are filing, they filed after July 1, 1997. All right, that's the 741 period. The extension was you have to file. There was a 2-year extension as to complaints that were filed before July 1, 1997 regarding discrimination occurring before December 31, 1996. Now, in the Garcia case, there are claims for other periods of time is what I'm getting at.
Again, I'm sorry to keep sort of repeating myself, but this case has always been focused as a class action to try to get ECOA relief.
No, actually, this case had three different claims to it, all right, and one of them was an APA claim. That's where this complaint is. They say they can sue under for discrimination. They can also, they have a claim or account for failing to follow regulations, and they want to bring that under the APA. And then they have this discrimination as to non-credit benefits. I mean, that's their case. And the district court basically, as I understand it, has thrown out everything except the first part. And that's the issue they're contesting now.
I understand that. And the district court did that on the basis that Congress understood this problem and gave two different ways of going about fixing the problem.
But you would you agree then that under ECOA, the plaintiffs will be unable in this lawsuit, as you say it's been styled, to obtain systemic injunctive relief?
I think that's a fair statement of the limitation of ECOA.
Let me ask you, what is your reaction to Mr. Hill and Ms. Wall both suggest that, you know, trying to build on McKenna, we're talking about something different. The possibilities for the APA relief here that they're talking about go to matters that are not within the contemplation of ECOA and whatever it was that Congress had in mind. They're really very different matters that can be attended to if you're allowed to pursue the APA claim. And therefore, a McKenna is a more relevant or more apt citation than the cases that you're relying on.
Well, as I think you pointed out, Your Honor, I really do think that's in opposite. McKenna, first of all, doesn't have a 704 component to it at all, so it really didn't consider that aspect.
Well, we did consider without citing 704, because I went back and read it, we absolutely did consider whether or not Title VII foreclosed the possibility of the APA relief. That's the same question. We're not that dumb. We understand what the law requires, and I was actually concerned that maybe we were that dumb. We were not that dumb. We absolutely understood the question, and we answered the question. And we said Title VII did not foreclose the APA because they were different.
I understand. I mean, I think sort of the distinction that can generally be drawn is that in most of the 704 cases, you know, including where it was considered sort of sub silentio, you know, they deal with a remedy that can go against a third party. Obviously, we have a different situation here. The remedy here is against the allegedly discriminating entity.
Right.
Here. So that
third
makes
third parties' cases, especially on the B side, they're not. They can't take you anywhere.
Well, we're on the A side.
Well, that's your argument. We're on the A side, right? But so their answer to that, you're on the A side, is yes, we understand we're on the A side, and normally we would be foreclosed. We had to pick A or B, but that's not what we're doing. We're picking A, and we want to go that route for those kinds of remedies, but this APA remedy is entirely different. It would allow us to seek entirely different kinds of relief.
Again, I think that allows precisely the sort of circumvention that the 704 decisions say you can't have. Wheel and Counsel of and for the Blind and the other cases talk about, there are lots of times a plaintiff wants to get what they call systemic relief. They want to be able to go directly after the discriminating agency. In the Wrestler's case, as you well know, they wanted to go directly after the Department of Education because they said the other suits.
It's a third party.
Well, I understand that, but the
third party cases are, well, especially when I'm looking at B, the third party suit cases are.
Well, I would encourage you to stay focused on A because I think that's where we are.
I understand that's where you want me to be, is A.
I think that's where we are.
I understand they've conceded that we're in A. These are A lawsuits.
But the point is that there clearly is a difference between the 704 cases that deal with third parties, but it's a difference that I think works in our favor because ultimately the remedy here is being provided against the discriminating entity. Yeah. It's something that is even more powerful and could be, you know, deemed effective.
Your answer is I think, the question that I was raising for counsel on the other side, that is, if you had gone B, you could have. Do you doubt that they could have sought mandamus if you had stonewalled?
If we had stonewalled, absolutely. There are specific time limits in B. I mean, the statute, isn't just sort of the general, you know, process discrimination complaints. The statute says, under B, that to the maximum extent practicable, they should be processed within 180 days after a date. You know, it's Congress's shout to the agency. Get on the ball.
Had they pursued B, whatever it provides, you don't have any doubt in your mind the track was available had the government done what they claim the government has been doing.
Again, the track considerations are sort of, you know, it's nebulous as to when delay becomes unreasonable, and the court's decisions sort of vary on, you know, when is it the stonewalling has become bad enough that you can come in under 706.1 without final agency action. But yes, at some level, I have no doubt that could occur. I don't think it's something that is in any way encompassed in this case because
let me ask you about that.
Well,
what would bar the plaintiffs from amending their complaint now on remand or even in this court to add an APA claim separate and distinct from the 741A claim?
One thing that I think would bar it is it doesn't make sense to be litigating that claim.
That's the plaintiff's choice, all right, in filing a complaint. It may not make sense, but if they want to do it, why couldn't they amend their complaint to add that APA claim?
I thought your answer was that you got to pick them, and if...
Yes.
And if...
No, but his answer is you got to pick them, but... Somebody could go down today.
Only if they have tried to go to the agency.
Well,
that's what I want to add.
I said I thought his answer was conceding the appellant's point because Farmer Garcia could go
down. I know, and he
down.
Kept saying no, I thought.
I certainly meant to keep fighting with you, Judge Rogers.
Yes.
and so I'm sorry if
no,
it looks like I conceded
want to be
clear. Something. And,
yeah.
And my point would be exactly the response. Yes, if you had gone through that process...
You had tried
yes.
to pursue an administrative
yes.
remedy and gotten stonewalled, and you could not go downstairs now, you're arguing, because you haven't tried. You
Precisely.
Haven't tried to use the procedures that you're now going to claim are inadequate.
Precisely, Your Honor. And I mean,
is that because the agency has amended the regulations?
No, it's because we have no showing that the agency's done anything wrong that would constitute unreasonable delay.
There are plaintiffs in the Garcia case who make this argument that they tried to file these applications, that they weren't investigated, et cetera. So why can't they move forward?
I'm not sure. Again, this is sort of coming out of the blue. I'm not sure what this particular group of plaintiffs alleges. I would have to look really closely at those claims. But to give you an example, Judge Edwards, the Benoit case that we cite, those are people that used, as Judge Friedman has just ruled, and it's on its way up to this court, those are people who used the B process. They're African-American farmers who were in some way didn't participate in the Pigford settlement. They were either opt out or they missed deadlines. And they tried to use the B process, and ultimately they didn't pursue the B process far enough down the line. They didn't pursue it to the final action, and they, you know, tried to come to court to say
a track claim.
I don't believe it's a track claim, but if for instance the agency had not acted on those complaints, just sat on its hands, they would have a track claim. That's what I'm trying to suggest, is that's the example of where you might have a track claim.
Well, I understand what you're arguing.
Sure.
You're saying to Judge Rogers that the folks here have not tried to pursue the administrative remedy, good, bad, or otherwise, which would be a condition precedent to filing the mandamus.
That's
track.
Correct.
But so I'm very clear. I understand that argument as to 741B. What I'm asking you about is, what would bar the plaintiffs from amending their complaint to say, we are pursuing 741A, but completely independent of 741, we are pursuing an APA claim?
Because I don't think that's what Congress contemplated when it enacted 741, that there would be this dual tracking. It's explicit in the statute, and again, I agree with you, the legislative history is sparse here, but it's explicit in the statute that there's an either-or choice. Go back to the agency, file an ECOA suit or other applicable suit with, you know, and you have a statute of limitations waiver that is really somewhat extraordinary. And it's explicit that it's either-or. So I don't think you could sort of get both in the same suit, I think is the bottom line answer here.
We've taken up a lot of your time.
Again, I'm happy to address anything else the court has, but I think the critical...
On the non-credit claim that was dismissed.
Sure.
Would you agree that because the district court's order said at this time that it was a dismissal that was not final, it's without prejudice?
I haven't considered the without prejudice aspect of it.
There's case law from this circuit and the Seventh Circuit and Moore's federal practice. When an order says at this time, it's not final.
Well, I mean, I think that we need to distinguish between the two sets of plaintiffs. The dismissal occurred in the Love case.
That's the only one I'm talking about.
Right. And it was the reason for it was that they didn't have a plaintiff before the court alleging that sort
said
of thing.
At this time.
Well, I understand. I'm just sort of trying to back up and give the grounds for why that was not an abuse of discretion, in that the plaintiffs had not filed any sort of motion to amend, to add any sort of complaint like that.
But he stayed for the consideration, I thought, in Love.
I'm not sure.
I can't imagine why you wouldn't say, well, you can understand we might remand on that to let the district court work it out in that claim, because clearly there's a possibility of an APA claim in those cases.
Well, I think there's...
You have arguments you want to raise, but we shouldn't consider them in the first instance.
Sure. And again, I don't think it's raised at all in Garcia, because I don't think there was any dealing with any sort of non-credit claim in Garcia. The district court's order in Garcia dismisses the failure to investigate claims at JA 529 and doesn't address these claims at all. So
they're still there.
I think that, yes.
The only question
again,
is whether you have the possibility of amending on the Love case, in the Love case.
I think that's probably right, Your Honor. But what I want to emphasize about that, because, and this is very important, is those are individual claims there.
Yeah, I understand. We understand that.
Well, but the problem is that to the extent there is any APA component left in this case, what is going to happen on remand is there's going to be a renewed motion for class certification based on asserted commonality among the APA claims. So even if the failure to investigate claim...
Which would cause us to do what?
Well, it would cause further delay.
In terms of our thinking about it. That's counsel's strategy. So what? I mean, that's interesting. But what do I do with that?
Well, again, it's the
you
understanding.
Want, you want us to preemptively cut them out from under their legs? That we don't do that.
I understand, Your Honor. So I guess I don't want you to do anything, but I do want you to understand that sort of it is important, and the court touched on this in talking to the counsel, that, you know, sort of the whole reason why this APA claim has been sort of so adamantly contested between the parties is to make it a predicate for commonality and try to see.
Okay. We understand that is lurking underneath, but
right.
But we can't get in the middle of your strategies. You have your strategies, and they may or may not work, but we do deal with the law and the facts of the case.
I understand. It's just it's in this case that the individually COA claims, you know, continue to sit there, and it's sort of further delay. And, you know, the agency stands ready to litigate those claims.
Can I give you another possible strategy?
Settle the case?
Yeah, right.
Well, again, if we could clear up the procedural problems here.
No, you don't need us to clear up procedural
counsel.
Problems to
you,
settle.
You walked into that.
I'm talking about going back downstairs.
Well, the case is
go back downstairs and settle.
The case sits in a very different posture if there's a possibility of class certification than it does if there's a possibility of, you know, just individually COA suits. It does. So this matters. This stuff matters in terms of understanding the settlement possibilities. That's all I'm trying to get at. I'm not expecting the court necessarily to do anything with that.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Counsel for Appellant Garcia.
A couple of quick points, Your Honor. Said we could wait for mandamus, and there seems to be some speculation as to what would have happened had we gone to track B, if you will. There really is no basis for speculation. Mrs.
Making sort of a futility argument.
Well, no, it's even better than that, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Gray testified without contradiction in her declaration at JA 528 that there was so little response, and understandably so, because they quashed the notice to minorities. There was so little response that they merged the two systems together. They both collapsed. Now what happened? We have Hispanic farmers who filed long before the 741 process, contemporaneous with the 741 process, and subsequent to that process. They all have in common the fact that to this very day, those complaints have not been investigated. With respect to McKenna, the government said one thing that I agree with at page 40 of their brief. McKenna simply confirms the unexceptional principle that in the context of a suit challenging discrete agency action, a plaintiff may challenge the agency's failure to follow mandatory procedures. That's all we're doing here. We have a situation-specific complaint, as I indicated at the outset of the argument, and we are filing it against the government. The government is a discriminator. The government has failed to follow its rules. Those rules are important. They have value to our clients. With respect to the track A, the 741A is not just limited to a COA. The government keeps saying that for reasons unknown to me. It extended the statute of limitations with respect to APA claims as well. And that's what we assert in our complaint. It's clear. It's very clear in the statute. At 741E subpart 2. It extended the statute of limitation with complaints with respect to the administration of commodity programs and disaster assistance programs, non-credit benefit programs. And we are asserting under that a failure to investigate claim, again, because those are separate and discrete agency actions. With respect to the notion that this is somehow all in the past, again, to this very day, USDA is refusing to investigate Hispanic farmers' complaints. We lay that all out in our brief. And just as one example, at page JA 383, we have the declaration of the lead plaintiff, Mr. Garcia, who filed a discrimination complaint in 2006. Still hasn't been investigated. No Hispanic farmer's complaint has been investigated by this agency, period. And on, well, that's it, unless there are some questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yep. One other thing. And this one was really cute. In response to a question from the bench, counsel said that he doesn't believe that that Judge Robertson has dismissed our non-credit APA claims. But he clearly argues in his brief that he has, and that they should be, and you cannot possibly reconcile his 11-30-07 opinion with his March 20th, 2002 opinion, where he said unequivocally that the Garcia plaintiffs have a plaintiff who has asserted a non-credit claim, and that plaintiff, Gloria Morales, satisfies all the requirements of 741. That has never been challenged in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. A counsel for Appellant Lowe.
It is our position, as we hopefully have made clear, that and it's our burden to demonstrate that 741A and 741B do not provide an adequate remedy. It is correct that we proceeded under 740A, and it's nonetheless our burden to demonstrate that 741B, which we didn't use, does not provide an adequate remedy, and we believe that the record is clear that that's the case in the following respects. Number one, with regard to a failure to investigate ECOA does not reach that because this court has said so. Secondly, there are different injuries, meaning you have the agency's injury for failing to take seriously or to even pursue the claims made by our claimants. And they are broader than simply a discrimination in connection with a credit decision. These involve things like, I came into the local office and they said that I couldn't get an application. These are more in the nature of, frankly, hostile environment or quid pro quo. And these are claims that the agency, under its own regulations, is required to review, because the agency is required to review discrimination in connection with any benefit, any program, any action. It's a broader mandate than simply ECOA, which is only a credit decision. Third, the remedies are different. As indicated, an ECOA remedy is mainly damages, some limited injunctive relief, and the remedies available via agency action are much broader, including systemic, the bad word, systemic activity. But it's true.
I mean, counsel, just so I'm clear, and maybe I'm just dense about this, but if one of the plaintiffs is claiming that a credit decision involved unlawful discrimination, why wouldn't all of these things you're mentioning, hostile environment, et cetera, just be taken care of in the measure of damages?
Because, by typical example, we submitted close to 2,000 declarations, and a huge number of those declarants said, I walked into the local farm service agency and I asked for an application, and they said variously, we don't have them, we don't give them to women, bring your husband in, we've given out all the money, come see me next week, or some other variation thereof. In some instances, those women had never farmed before. In some instances, their farming ventures were nascent. Their ability to prove damages related to the inability to get an application is nil. So ECOA would provide them with virtually no protection with regard to compensatory damages. In fact, with respect to Mr. Scarborough's comment about compensatory damages under ECOA are adequate, my claimant who walked in to try to get an application is the classic case. And we have huge numbers of those claimants. They simply couldn't get even the building block to get a loan. And that's the kind of thing that would be reviewed by the agency. And the agency, under its own regulations, could take steps to deal with not only that applicant getting an application, but also the agency policing of its own activity. And also, with regard to why the remedies are not congressional intent under 741 and 748 is important here as well. While I think we've all gone back and forth about what did Congress really mean, it takes us to take a step back and look at this from the Bowen perspective. Bowen and Abbott Labs were very clear that there's supposed to be liberal review of agency action, and more importantly, legislative intent to bar review has to be shown by clear and convincing evidence. That is simply missing here. And last, I want to state the obvious, and it may be obvious to the bench, maybe not. I'm not sure it's obvious to USDA. Really, what's at issue here is whether this agency can get away with 40 years of discriminating against minorities without those minorities having any access to judicial review for those actions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.